Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how big companies like Coca-Cola are paying nutritionists to say good things about them. Well, that's not cool, because there's nothing good to say about Coca-Cola, and we'll tell you why. We're also going to talk about trans fats, but not saturated fats are linked to greater risk of death and heart disease from McMaster University. We're also going to explore how the omega-3 fatty acids can block psychosis years later from University of Melbourne in Australia. And also how muscle and movement and exercise, well, that helps you live a longer life, a lot longer. And music is more effective than drugs at releasing the brain's painkillers. And not drinking enough water has the same effect as drunk driving. From the Telegraph, motorists who are dehydrated make twice as many mistakes, according to a study, and a lot more on health and healing. Also today, on the atom bomb's 70th anniversary last week, Obama wants to spend $1 trillion on new nuclear weapons. Where's the outrage? Where is the moment where all the major media take a look and say, you've got a nation of 243 Americans who are in crisis. You have 100 million Americans at or below the poverty level. Another 153 million Americans who are slightly above it. You have, for the first time in American history, you have 3 million Americans living on under $2 a day, what we would normally consider a living standard in Africa, right now in the United States. But you have the temerity, along with the corporate liberal Democrat class, to spend $1 trillion that could help these people, de-ghettoize America, rebuild our infrastructure, and you put it into war and no condemnation? What does that say about us as a nation? And for condemnation, Bernie Sanders is getting a bump up. People are paying attention to his message, at least the message they know, because there's a lot of messages Senator Sanders has not shared with you. I certainly support what he is doing. It is noble. It is honest on civil rights, on protecting Social Security. He's doing a lot of good things. If only he would extend that to the military-industrial complex, to spying on us, to our foreign policies, to his worshiping Israel, and the other things that he is not discussing that he should. Well, it shows that Hillary Clinton's State Department deeply involved in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. How do we know? Well, we now have, thanks to the work of David Sorda, the actual transcripts, and these transcripts show that on more than 45 separate occasions, Hillary Clinton, as head of the State Department, promoted the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, let's see what she says when she's in a debate and her support for it. Also, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says money is why Congress is stalling the autism cover-up hearings. And a former DIA chief, Michael Flynn, says the rise of the Islamic State was, quote, a willful decision, and defends the accuracy of his statement, meaning the United States Department of Defense and its Defense Intelligence Agency, he was the head of it, director of it, so he knows more about our defense and its intelligence than any other person on the planet, because he gets it before the president, he selects what the president sees, what Congress hearings officers see. So he's the filter, he's the cipher, and he says, we created ISIS. We created the rise of the Islamic State. We did it with intent. I will quote him verbatim. So remember that. We created the enemy. and funded them, along with Saudi Arabia. Also today, we'll have a guest in the second part of our program, Derek Jensen. Derek has become one of the nation's leading voices of cultural and environmental dissent. He writes on how civilization is devastating the environment and the natural world, and our society's denial of that fact. Utney Reader listed Derek among the 50 visionaries changing the world. So we're going to talk today about our culture of narcissistic feelings, educational failures, and how it serves the capitalist system. Also today, you're going to hear from some people who are with us right now at a retreat, and I thought it might be fun for you to hear what they're experiencing. I've not spoken with them. I have no idea what their ideas are. It's unedited, unrehearsed, unscripted. So whatever they say, that's what they experience. And we're doing this as a fundraiser for one of our stations. We're on a lot of stations, but one of them is WBAI, and it needs help. So a lot of people, over 20 individuals, sacrifice time and energy, hundreds of hours, to help the station. And it's working. 2 weeks ago, we managed to pay over 500 bills for the station. It had no money to pay a single bill. Its fundraiser, unfortunately, at this time, was not successful. But we are now going to be paying more bills today and next week even more. Our goal is 1,000 bills that my office will pay for the station. What do we get in return? Nothing. Is this a good model? It's a terrible model, and we're only doing it one time, with the hope that we can get the station through this crisis so that they'll get on their feet where they deserve to be and honor and support the audience that has been so patient and so supportive of it over the years. But the whole foundation's in crisis. It's all imploding at every level for a lot of bad reasons. And there are a lot of good people, honest people, noble people, kind people, very smart people affiliated with Pacifica at all levels, from the local station boards to the national boards to different programs and hosts. But the people who have caused this problem are all in power. And as long as they maintain that power at the national level and local power, we're not going to see an improvement. But I'll deal with that on an upcoming show. Nutritionists are challenging Coca-Cola. Why? Because Coca-Cola is smart. They've got money and they've got psychologists and behavioralists, and they figure out, why don't we get nutritionists on our side? So what do they do? According to Nadia Purpus, Coca-Cola is funding influential scientists pushing a message that diminishes the role of junk food and sweetened beverage in the obesity crisis. A partnership has drawn the ire of nutritional experts since it was highlighted earlier this week. The Global Energy Balance Network on Monday released a promotional video claiming that there is, quote, no compelling evidence that soft drinks or fast foods contribute to America's declining health, and that consumers should worry about exercising than cutting calories to lose weight. In turn, media outlets swiftly highlighted that the Global Energy Balance Network lists the world's largest producer of sugary sodas as one of its major financial backers. There's an association that, as nutrition professor Barry Popkin told The Guardian on Tuesday, exposes the organization as, quote, merchants of doubt, akin to the scientists for hire who deny the harmful effects of tobacco. Quote, essentially, Coca-Cola is following the strategy used by the tobacco industry as they try to create doubt among the general public and also politicians. It was also very effective in the fights to regulate cigarettes, and we have learned from this that it is essential to address these attempts to uncover what is happening. All right, and he is a professor of nutrition at University of North Carolina. Well, more concerning is the consensus among nutritional experts that sugary sodas not only contribute to the obesity epidemic, they're the leading cause. As the Harvard University School of Public Health explains, sodas are more rightfully described as liquid candy, and that it, As sugary drink portion sizes have grown over the last 40 years, children and adults have all drastically increased their consumption. According to the U.S. CDC, two-thirds of Americans are overweight or obese. And while physical activity is an essential component, I've explained that many times to this audience, you can't be healthy without exercising. A healthy lifestyle and preventing of these starts with getting rid of all processed sugars and artificial sweeteners and soft drinks. And that is the science. Quote, obesity and NCD scholars and World Health Organization and many other bodies have all realized that for prevention, we must change our diet. First and foremost, that is sugary sweetened beverages, end quote. And the director of the Center for Human Nutrition at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, quote, in the bigger picture, it's food intake or exercise that dominates as cause of obesity. You cannot exercise your way out of overeating. That's kind of a misguided idea. But, hey, kudos for Coca-Cola and all your stockholders and all of your board of directors and all your people in Atlanta. You're smart, and you almost got away with it. Almost. All right? But fortunately, we've exposed you for what you are and always have been and always will be. You make your money. You honor your stockholders. You do a good job of it. You're exemplary at making your stock valuable. Why haven't you ever once, not once in your career, taken credit for how many people's obesity, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, and other problems are caused in no small measure and in part by the consumption of your colas? Not once. A little integrity, along with a lot of profit, would show some semblance of caring. Do you really think the average American is that dumb? Or do you think as long as you can get scientists for hire and say, don't worry about what you're drinking and eating sugar, it's not going to cause a problem, that they're going to say, oh, okay, any American who chooses not to change anything out of comfort or any other rationale that they have created don't need a scientist to tell them, keep eating your junk food. It's good for you. They've already determined that. But for anyone who wants to be willfully aware instead of willfully ignorant, they don't need a scientist to tell them something's good or bad. They're using intuition and self-determination. Now, trans fats is another issue. We should not forego all saturated fats because they're not all bad. But trans fats are all bad. And we have consumed an enormous amount of trans fats in our diet. Think of all the confections from donuts and bagels and french fries and pizza crusts, trans fats, a lot of other things. So there is no redemption for trans fats. But for saturated fats, it depends upon the source. If you're eating saturated fat from beef, you're getting a byproduct called arachidonic acid, and that causes inflammation, and that's not good. But if you're getting saturated fats from coconut, coconut meat, coconut milk, coconut water, that's a good trans fat, a medium-chain fatty acid that has antiviral, antibacterial properties. It's anti-inflammatory. It actually turns off inflammation in the brain. And that's why I recommend it for everyone that I counsel who has a brain condition. So, this is from McMaster's University. Quote, a study led by researchers at McMaster's University has found that trans fats are associated with a greater risk of death and coronary heart disease, but saturated fats are not associated with an increased risk of death, heart disease, stroke, or type 2 diabetes. That's so important, and we've said it many times, but here McMaster's University scientists are saying, so I'm going to repeat it. Trans fats, that's your junk foods, are associated with greater risk of death and coronary heart disease, but saturated fats are not associated with an increased risk of death, heart disease, stroke, or type 2 diabetes. The findings are published in today's British Medical Journal. And the lead author, Dr. Souza, professor in the Department of Clinical Epidemiology and Biostatistics, said, quote, "For years, everyone has been advising to cut out fats. Trans fats have no health benefits and pose a significant risk of heart disease, but the case for saturated fat is less clear." Okay, so we know they're good fats. Now, what are the best fats? All right, those would be your omega-3 fatty acids. You can get them from wild salmon. You can get them from sardines. But you can also get a vegan form from walnuts, avocados, flax seeds. And plus there, you're also getting the beneficial minerals, phytonutrients, and fibers. You don't get that from the fish oils. Both are good for you. Both work. Fats are also good if they are from olives and nuts. Pine nuts, pistachios, macadamia nuts are very good for you. Plus, every form of olive is also good. So this is where we should be getting our primary fats and oils. And mentioning that, from the University of Melbourne is a really interesting study, and it shows that, quote, omega-3 fatty acids, what I was just referring to, found in oily fish may prevent the onset of schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders long after consumed. Up to 7 years after taking omega-3 supplements for 12 weeks, young people at ultra-high risk were less likely to have suffered the debilitating condition than a control group given a placebo. Okay, let's take a look at that. Let's break it down. The best fats we're getting are from nuts and seeds. Sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, sesame seeds, hemp seeds, those are your best oils. Add in your walnuts, almonds, peanuts are terrific. And organic peanuts are one of nature's most perfect proteins and oils. Now, let's say that you are a teen and you're very hyper. We don't know why you're hyper. It might be hyper because it's your natural metabolism. It could be because you're extremely creative and exuberant. It could be because you're suffering from vaccine injury or maybe cell phone overuse, and as a result, you're overstimulating chromosomes in the brain. Or it may be because you're not sleeping at night, or you sleep with your cell phone under your pillow and your laptop on your chest in case someone should at 3 o'clock in the morning, one of these mystical, magical, gypsy friends of yours who says, "Oh, I just had to let you know that I just burped and it's 2:33 a.m. Glad to share it with all my friends." And you say, "Oh, I just snored, so I'm going to share a picture of me snoring." What a world. So there's a lot of reasons that you could have a hyper nature. Or you could be on Ritalin. That'll really give you a hyper nature. But no matter what the cause, if you take the omega-3 fatty acids for 12 weeks, up to 7 years later, you're going to be calmer. It was 11 years ago that a group of school teachers approached me and two people within the Board of Education in New York City, one of the most corrupt, inept, inefficient bureaucracies ever created. I would have to go to the Indian postal system in Delhi to find something more incompetent. But be that as it may, these were the people inside who were not, who really cared, like there's teachers that care. And they said, "Can you help with hyperactivity, because it's endemic?" And first I explained most hyperactivity isn't due to a brain chemical imbalance. None of it's due to a brain chemical imbalance. It doesn't exist. There is no such thing as a brain chemical imbalance. However, there are a lot of things that can cause this. If you get up in the morning because you haven't slept at night, you're tired, "Get up, Jimmy, it's time to go to bed. Time to go to school. I'm too tired." Well, why are you too tired? Because you didn't go to bed at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and went to bed at 2 o'clock. Well, it's time to go to school. So they have a cola, or they have caffeine, or they have a double caffeine, or they have espresso or a double espresso. Now they got 300, 500 milligrams caffeine. They are wired. There's no way, even with a straight jacket and duct tape, you're going to keep someone who's got 500 milligrams of caffeine in them from overreacting. So they're not going to pay attention. Very easy at that point for someone to misdiagnose them as ADD or ADHD. So I said, first take a group of students, ones that you know, and the parents are willing to try this. It all has to be voluntary. And they did. And I said, let's get rid of all the caffeine, all the sugar, all the fructose, all the refined carbohydrates, and then insist that they put down the cell phones, turn off the laptops, and have an evening with you, the parent, doing things together. Go to a movie together, go to a recreation park together, miniature golf, whatever you want to do. Do something as a family. Sit and talk. Read a book. And a small group did. But they got to get into bed, whether they can sleep or not, they got to be there. Now let's start rebuilding their biochemistry with melatonin and with B-complex and with folic acid B12. Within 12 weeks, every single one, no exceptions, 100% of those were normal acting kids. They had all been diagnosed with ADD and ADHD. None of them were. So that's something that we have to pay attention to. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment, and let's do this break with a little inspiration. I believe we can be inspired and feel something. It doesn't matter what your belief or no belief. It's just good to feel good, and this guy gets you feeling good. I grew up with my favorite music always been gospel. When we sang in the First Christian Church, it was boring. No one ever moved. I don't even think they moved their lips, let alone their tongue, when they were singing. I had to go down to the Baptist Church down on Clay Street after my church to hear this kind of gospel music. And that's just inspiring, no matter what your belief. We'll be back in a moment with our guest. Please stay with us. With us, everyone. Let's say hello to Derek Jensen. Derek's in Northern California. I mentioned his bio a little earlier in the program, and he is advocating for many years a dismantling of the whole concept of how we do our lives and come up with a new awareness. And he's on the phone now. Nice to have you with us today, Derek.
Hey, it's nice to be on again.
Derek, there has been a serious decline in critical thinking in our culture. People like Henry Giroux and Chris Hedges and Rick Schenkman and others have written extensively on what's happening to our society. In large part, our over-reliance and unhealthy relationship to technology and the Internet has partially contributed to this growing trend. And I perceive technology as contributing a new kind of isolationism that reinforces the dysfunctions of individualism by removing people from real-life encounters with their communities and with culturally diverse people. When people are forced to engage in and face real-life encounters that community involvement presents, our horizons broaden. In particular, the Internet now disengages people, especially the younger generation, from having to confront the other. And that isolationism ends up reinforcing our own illusions about ourselves and the world. We can cherry-pick what we find commonality with and ignore the rest. And this only further solidifies pet beliefs and strengthens the psychology of entitlement and self-centeredness and narcissism. At least that's my belief. And furthermore, if a person is ensnarled in such a mindset, there can be no critical thought or reflective ability to question his or her assumptions. So would you further comment on this? And how do you see the culture of narcissism and entitlement, which has grown rapidly during the past 15 years, as playing into the hands of the dominant capitalist agenda and creating a new form of McCarthyism? And ultimately, for whom? And how does capitalism exploit the self-delusions of the younger generation? The forum is yours.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said. I was checking Facebook. What'd you say? sorry to make a joke out of that, but everything you said was absolutely brilliant and right on. And I completely agree. And one of the things that I want to mention right away is that I came across this thing in Scientific American several years ago that said that there was a study that showed that college students had become 40% less empathetic in the previous 30 years. And when I first read that, it's like, how do you study that somebody's 40% less empathetic? What does that mean? I mean, how do you quantify empathy? But the study's actually kind of interesting that what they did is they just asked 10,000, I think, or some huge number of students, both in 1980 and then again in 2010, do you agree with statements like, sometimes to help me understand my friends, I will look at things from their perspective? And, you know, a lot, 40% more students these days would disagree with that statement. How can you disagree with that statement? Well, I mean, obviously, if you don't do it. Or sometimes I have empathy for people who are less fortunate than I. And 40% more students would disagree with that statement in 2010 than in 1980. And they said the greatest increase was in the previous 9 years, so 2001 to 2010. And that's, I don't think it's a coincidence at all that correlates to the sort of explosion of Internet culture. And I don't want to blame the Internet for it, the Internet alone for it. I think it's a confluence of a whole host of influences, or maybe it's all just one big influence. These are different manifestations of it. But one of the things that I said in an essay that I just wrote for Counterpunch is that, you know, 4 decades ago was called the Me Generation. That was the 1970s were called that. I remember that from the time. And, you know, how much worse have things gotten since then? And what are some of the confluences that, or what are some of the things that come together to do that? And there's, you know, the rise of neoliberalism. We have, if you remember Margaret Thatcher's famous line from the 80s about how, what was it? It basically, there is no society, there are only individuals in society. You know, capitalism pushes us to be narcissistic. Consumerism pushes us to be narcissistic. Incessant advertising pushes us to be that way. Corporate culture, the selfish gene theory, neoliberalism I already mentioned, postmodernism, the internet culture, all of these are coming together to make, well, there's that plus, I mean, there's something that, both of us have been talking about for decades, which is we hear so often about how, I remember something a few years ago that the average child spends 8 minutes outside these days, as opposed, in the real world, as opposed to in the virtual world. And all of those come together to create a, to lead to additional narcissism and to, as you said, entitlement in the young people growing up and, of course, older people too. So I wrote this essay that was in Counterpunch a couple days ago about how deplatforming at universities has skyrocketed. It's gone up 6 times. Deplatforming is where somebody gets invited to do a talk, and then because some special interest group complains, they get disinvited. And that's increased 6 times between 2002 and 2013, I believe, or 2001 and 2012. And that is an extraordinary rise of that. And a lot of times they'll be deplatformed because one or another, as I said, special interest group will say, I don't like what that person has to say. And so instead of arguing with them, or instead of setting up another speaker that can hold a different view, then they say we simply will not, we cannot allow this person to talk. And that, of course, is the death knell for any pluralistic society. That's it's a very, very, I mean, it's an unfair tactic in any case, because if you, you know, and it doesn't matter whether you are a lefty who is going to deplatform a right winger, or a right winger deplatforming a lefty, or a capitalist deplatforming somebody because they speak out against capitalism. One of the things it says is that you are insecure enough in your position that you can't allow anyone else to speak. So I'm sort of rambling here. So ask me another question.
Well, no, you're doing fine. You were telling us what we needed to hear on that issue. Now tomorrow, my guest is Jim Garrison. You know Jim. He's the president of Ubiquity University and one of the great thinkers, used to head the Gorbachev Foundation. And he'll discuss the utter failure of higher education today and how it no longer prepares most students for the challenges young adults will face in the near future. And aside from the subjects that are usually spoon-fed to college students and the degeneration of higher education's culture today, in your latest Counterpunch article that you were just referring to, you raised the question of our culture's problem today, whereby having to honor a person's feelings trumps all critical thought. Engaged in discourse or debate and multiculturalism and pluralism, and we have become a culture that nurtures the tyranny of an ego over the democracy of the soul. And it is the most base, immature, and dysfunctional characteristics of the ego that are now being hardened and glorified. And what interests me is your comments about how this has shaped young people's views about the unsustainable industries that control our planet, the destruction of the environment, the specter of extinction in the wake of extreme climate change and global warming. So could you extend your thoughts on that, please?
Well, it's over the past several years, I've talked to numerous college instructors, especially adjuncts, which is a whole other thing, the exploitation of adjuncts. But I've talked to numerous adjunct professors who have said to me that they are afraid of their students. And what they mean by that is not that they're afraid their students are going to bring guns in and shoot them, but they're afraid that if they say anything that any student finds politically objectionable, that the student will complain to the administration and their contract will not be renewed. In other words, they'll be fired. So, and this has been enough students that, enough instructors have said this to me, that it's not just one being nervous. This is a pattern where, you know, I taught at Eastern Washington University back in the 90s, and I was never afraid of throwing out political positions. And I had this unique grading system where I didn't actually judge students' papers. And one of the things that did is it would basically, I graded them on how much they wrote. And the point of that was that I could throw out any opinion I wanted, and they knew that I didn't control their grade. They could throw out any opinion they wanted. And we had great discussions in class, in part because, I mean, we didn't have the fear that if I said something, I mean, I remember one time I had a student come in. This was kind of creepy. I had a student come in, and she said because I was teaching my students free thinking that I was endangering their soul. She was a fundamentalist Christian, and she started praying for my soul. And, you know, it was kind of creepy, but it didn't mean that I was going to get fired. And there are numerous cases these days. There was one case I cited in the Counterpunch article where this teacher's contract was not renewed because students complained that he exposed them to, quote, offensive, end quote, text written by Edward Said and Mark Twain. And I keep thinking, who are the adults here? I mean, the professors or the instructors have been turned basically into codependent babysitters as opposed to actual teachers. And I don't mean to sound like, you know, those old people who saying, you know, when I was a kid, but I remember when I was in college, the instructors had no fear. I mean, there would be an instructor would say to us, I remember this one guy, James Brown, or J.T. Brown, one of my professors, would say quite often on Friday, he would say, you are going to hate me all weekend because you're going to spend the weekend doing electromagnetic, you know, problems. And, you know, start tonight because these homework assignments are going to take you until Sunday at 2 o'clock in the morning. And he would say it smiling, and, we had to do the work. And likewise, when I was in college, the School of Mines, where I went to, Colorado School of Mines, brought Edward Teller, who is one of the most horrible human beings of the 20th century. And I'm not promoting the notion that schools should have really offensive people, but maybe they should, because 35 years later, one of my classes required that I attend, and the only day I remember of that class, 35 years later, is the next day when we discussed Edward Teller. That is literally the only day I remember. And the teachers used Edward Teller. They used our upset at what he had said to help teach us critical thinking. Like, okay, you didn't like him? Great. Tell me why you didn't like him. Build a case. Tell me what is insane about what he said. And they would hold us to a rigor. They wouldn't just let us say, wow, he was really offensive, and then leave it at that. We had to build an argument. And that's one of the things that isn't happening here. There, I mean, I've been deplatformed because I would, quote, hurt the feelings of some of the students. And, you know, ever since the Counterpunch article came out a couple of days ago, I've gotten notes from several people, several college instructors or college professors, who are saying that this is exactly what's going on with their students, that their students are being, that they are afraid, as I just said, to challenge the students, because challenge the students politically, because if they do, the students will complain. I don't know how to wrap my mind around this level of a terror of critical thinking. I guess one more thing I want to say about this is that I love the word educator, which comes from the root edukera, which means to lead forth or draw out. And originally it was a Greek midwife's term meaning to be present at the birth of. And what that has to do with the current situation is that that implies that the teacher, the educator, is supposed to be an adult who is leading the student forth. That's your job. And if you are always afraid that you're going to hurt their feelings, and if you're always afraid that you may say something that politically crosses them, you're not actually being the adult.
Derek, I think part of my frustration and your frustration when we around people who want to be there because they expect to feel good about the experience. That comes from a culture phenomenon now where people care about how they feel. And if you don't allow people to feel good about the moment they're in or being with you or what you said, then there's no message to share. It's just about the feelings. And that comes from a culture that believes that a lot of parents that believes their child is so perfect, is so beautiful, so wonderful, that you cannot say anything that's going to let them face the world as it really is. There's too many harsh realities, and we want to spare them from that. And give you an example, with my new documentary, Saving the Planet, One Bite at a Time, you'll see a scene in there at the very end where a group of young people attending a rock concert, having a good time, was asked, what about the food, and shown different plates, a hot dog, hamburger, pizzas, you know. And then, do you know where this comes from? Well, it comes from animals. Yes, but there, do you know how those animals are dealt with to get your hot dog, hamburger? And then they looked into a monitor and had to see about a minute, 60 seconds, that's all, of how each, the chickens for the chicken they were eating, the pork, you know, for the pork chops, bacon, and they started to cry. They couldn't handle it. They were completely removed. We're talking about over 60 people. Not one man or woman could handle that reality. And then the question was, is this going to make you any more conscious of the choices you make? Will you continue eating this food knowing that these creatures suffer? And they said, I don't know. But, you know, you shouldn't have shown me this. I've never seen anything like this. This is terrible. As if we are terrible for showing them the connection between what they're eating and where it comes from. Not that they're eating it is terrible and they should be responsible, or society that condones factory farming and the slaughter and harm of animals, but their being conscious of it is the problem. They're feeling bad at the moment when they came to a rock concert feel good. That is endemic within our society.
I completely agree. And, you know, R.D. Lang, the psychiatrist, came up with the three rules of a dysfunctional family, and there are also three rules of a dysfunctional culture. And rule A is don't. Rule A1 is never discuss existence or non-existence. I'm sorry. Rule A1 is don't. Rule A2 is rule A1 does not exist, and rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A1 or A2. And what this means on a family level is that if you're in an abusive situation, you can talk about anything you want except for the abuse you have to pretend isn't happening. And then on a larger scale, we can talk about anything we want except for the corporations that are killing the planet. We can't talk about any of those scary or difficult and most important issues. And we have to, our feelings have to be protected at any moment. But, you know, there's a couple lines that I think about. One of them is that somebody asked Anton Chekhov, he said, some young writer said, I want to write a story. What should I write about? And the Anton Chekhov wrote back, I want you to write a story about somebody who squeezes every drop of slave's blood out of himself. And I want to tie that to what an American Indian writer said, Jack Forbes, and I'm going to do not a very good job of this, but basically he said that in order to get away from your own degradation, from what has been done to you by the system, in order to get away from that, you have to first look at the conditions that you're in. You have to first look at your own participation in this degradation and the degradation that's been done to you. Or let's just be real simple. It's like a doctor friend of mine says, the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And can you imagine if medical system was handled the same way that what you just described is handled, or these university systems are handled, where you go to the doctor and the doctor says, I'm sorry, you have emphysema, and this means, you know, maybe you should stop smoking, and then you get really pissed off at the doctor because, I mean, how dare you show me pictures of what my lung looks like? And
yes,
the point is not, I mean, it really, and the internet ties all this together too, because this culture, it prefers its fantasy. That's why my second book was called The Culture of, or my fourth or fifth book, whatever, it was called The Culture of Make-Believe, is because this culture prefers make-believe to what is real. And what is true with both your and my work, one of the things that ties them together is that the belief that physical reality is more important than what you tell yourself about physical reality. At every step of the way, physical reality is more important than ideology. It's more important. I'm not saying that there aren't other things besides physical reality. But what I'm saying is it's primary. And if we're going to, like when people say, how do we stop global warming? They're never asking that question. They're saying, how do we stop global warming without changing anything about the way we live? And they're saying this on every level. And what's central to all these and what ties these all back to this is the narcissism of the belief that my feelings and my convenience and my anything else are more important than what is going on in the real physical world. And that's completely nuts. And my feelings are more important than public discourse. And that's nuts. We're facing desperate situations, and we need to be able to, I mean, if we're killing the world, the least we can do is face it honestly.
We can't do that because we don't face our own life honestly. We don't even know who we are. We know what we do. We take our identity from our culture, from our religion, from our career. We take our identity from our pain. We create stories about ourselves and then reinforce the stories with constant reminding of the people in our lives about if we're a victim, how much we're victimized. But when someone says you can change the story, you can write a new story for your life, that means you have to stop for a moment and say, well, then where do I begin this journey I'm about to take? This week we had people who came, and they're two distinctly unique groups. One is a group from our audience in WBAI, and these people are pretty grounded. You know, one of the things I love about living in New York my entire adult life is, you know, you don't have to guess what someone's feeling or thinking. They're going to tell you. Right or wrong, they're going to tell you. Not so elsewhere. And because they have a kind of a raw grasp on reality. And elsewhere, you get people giving you statements based upon what they think you want to hear instead of what you need to hear. We need to hear the truth no matter how upsetting it may be. We have to get out of the idea that everything every day should be for our comfort. And one day you don't realize that your comfort could be killing people. One final example. We've had a visitor at a retreat who is one of America's leading oncologists. And I asked her, have you ever seen any advanced cancer case cured by using anything within your paradigm? She said, no, never. And she said, but I've heard that you have had success, and I was curious. And I said, then what did you find after talking with people who've been successful in their journey? And she said, I want to take this back. And I said, do you want to take it back to change your own practice? Do you want to take it back to try to influence others in your career? And she said, that's just not possible. And she made a statement to a woman that she suggested come to this retreat, who is terminally ill and who is virtually dead. You cannot imagine a cancer in every organ of her body. Yet she was her primary physician. And the woman last night said the following. She said, I'm really angry. And I said, what are you angry about? She said, I'm angry at the fact that my doctors, when I told them I was sick, when I told them I couldn't take anymore, they just kept saying, well, try this other drug. We'll try this other drug. And it was only when her hands turned black and she lost her feeling, she said, I will not do anything more. And I said, do you realize the doctors were simply giving you what they knew, and they don't know anything else because they cannot learn anything else except the chemotherapy. Otherwise, it would change the paradigm. And by changing the paradigm, you change the entire way medicine is practiced. So none of those doctors are going to come and look at you if you succeed, if you get your life back. They can't, because it means at some point there's going to be a clarion moment where they have to say, my God, we just killed 553,000 people from cancer last year who believed in us, trusted us, did everything we did. And the second largest morgue in America at Sloan Kettering is filled with people who, based upon our flawed paradigm, will there be any committee meeting? Will there be any national debate? Will there be any discussion about are we on the right approach for cancer? There will not. There'll be more parades. There'll be more wearing pink ribbons. There'll be more marches for the cure, all of which contribute to the destruction of lives and the solidification of the wrongness of the so-called powerful paradigm. I said, you're lucky. You finally pushed away the oncologist before the oncologist once again triumphed at the altar of narcissism and hubris. did any doctor in America last year apologize to the families of the patients they treated and give back the money they got? Not one. Will they? Never. So I said, no matter how many people survive, and using another course, it will never be a moment to change the paradigm. Your final thought?
Well, I think we can just extend this to the entire planet, that at this point, we as a collective, I'm not talking about us individually, we as a collective would rather kill the planet than admit that we've made some mistakes and that we've had a wrong paradigm. And that is one of the reasons that this discourse is so, so important, that if the first rule of a dysfunctional family is don't speak about it, then the first rule of a dysfunctional family or culture is to speak out and to, we can't, there are some of us, I mean, it's like part of the reason that the original McCarthyism ended, insofar as it did, was because finally enough people just stood up and said, have you no shame? And there needs to be people who have the courage to do that now, whether they're taking on the medical establishment or whether they're taking on the entire industrial complex or whether they're taking on the academia. We have to stand up and start by, you know, I've liked what Howard Zinn said about he doesn't think we should speak truth to power, because they already understand. But what we have to do is we have to speak truth about power. I think that's desperately important. And I think that's the first step. It's not the only step, but it is the first step.
Well, Derek, you've been doing that for a while, and I appreciate it, and I know others do as well. The Derek Jensen Reader, Writings on Environmental Revolution, as well as Earth at Risk, Building a Resistance Movement to Save the Planet. He also hosts a weekly radio show, Resistance Radio, on the Progressive Radio Network. All the best to you, Derek. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you. You too.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.